Hey, y'all. Welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him, your host, Scott Horton. Good show for you today, I hope. Should be. Our old friend John Pfeffer is going to be here from Foreign Policy and Focus Institute for Policy Studies, guy. They're liberals. They're anti-war. I'll take it. Good old John Pfeffer. He's one of the few guys I know who can really speak credibly about North Korea policy. That's not what we're going to be talking with him about today. Unless, I don't know, maybe. But nah, Syria. That's the piece I want to talk about, his Syria piece there at FPIF, Foreign Policy and Focus. Good old John Pfeffer. And then also David Vine's going to be here. You might remember he was supposed to be the KPFK guest last weekend, but that fell through. And so we talked with the great Eric Margulies instead, which worked out just fine, thank you. But David Vine is going to be on the show today, which is nice because I want to talk to him about a thing that he wrote. Which, that's basically how the show works. I read things and then I arrange interviews with the people who wrote the things that I read that I want to talk with them about. That's why it's called The Scott Horton Show. It should be called Recommended Reading with Scott Horton. There you go. All right. So, I got a ton of news to talk about before I get to the interviews, and I've got extra emails out that haven't been answered yet, so it's possible that there's going to be one more guest. So, I'm going to have to really go fast to make sure to cover as much as I possibly can in my own news that I don't have interviews for, but that I want to talk to you about before interview time starts in half an hour from now. So, first of all, So this bum in L.A. got shot for holding a stick in his hand and claimed the cops. Vice magazine sent a reporter down there, talked to the bums. And two other bums said that he didn't have a stick, man. There was no stick. And that guy, he was a nice old guy. He's never hostile to anybody. He always just sat there all day and whatever. He was a cool old bum. They just killed him. Now, who knows if you can take what those other bums said to the bank. Maybe he did have a stick, but geez, a bum with a stick, and the L.A. sheriffs had no choice but to kill him, huh? And then that got me thinking, man, maybe it is just a matter of the social media nowadays where local news stories become national news stories due to the Facebook and what have you. Otherwise, these things would just be, you know, buried and gone. And maybe it's just the Will Grigg in me where I just have such a confirmation bias against police that all this stuff just sticks out like sore thumbs to me. But I started thinking, and without cheating, this is the list of people that have been killed by the cops, completely innocent people, never mind somebody who may have done a little something and they executed him. But these are completely innocent people. Or, you know, very, very innocent, if not completely, right? This bum may have had a stick, but even if he did, what? You know, kind of thing. But anyway, these are just from like the last month or maybe 6 weeks. Off the top of my head, of people been killed by the cops who shouldn't have been killed by the cops. The bum in L.A., the black guy that got shot in the back of the neck by the Austin Police Department, over on 34th Street, Shoal Creek. The football star who'd been in a car wreck, and because he was black and banged loudly on the door, a frightened housewife called 911 on him when all he wanted was some help. So they came and killed him. And the only reason that that one was a big deal was because he was a football star, and so people knew him who he didn't know. He was a name around. He was an honorary white guy. He wasn't just some poor, uneducated black guy from the bad part of town who you can just get by killing. Oops. it's hard to tell. They all look alike, you know, when they're running at you asking for help. So they killed him. And anyway, that's the only reason that that became a big deal. You know, I think if this list was, you know, unarmed black guys killed by the cops who didn't make the national news, it would be a lot longer list. But anyway, then there was a lady the other day who, did you guys see this? Tell me you saw this. If you didn't see this, this is a thing. Man, I don't make this stuff up. This is a thing. Lady called an ambulance. Not the cops. She called an ambulance because her boyfriend, or husband, I forget, was, she thought, having a bad reaction to his diabetes medication. No mention of violence. She didn't say his diabetes medication is making him freak out like PCP or something. Just, I need help, please. 911, help me. I learned on TV that they'll help you if you call that number, you know. The cops walk into her house, shoot the guy dead. And she says, what? Oh, and they tried to say he had a knife or something. She says, he didn't have a knife at all. She said, and this is how you know she was telling the truth, man. This is how I know she was telling the truth. Here's the way she put it. She goes, it was like some silent movie or something. They just walked in and just didn't even say a word. They just drew their guns and killed him. Just shot him. Bang! You know, that's the part where the silent movie rang out. What? Call EMS and get executed. And then, of course, there's the DC lady who they're saying now that she was a little bit crazy and maybe she did try to bang her car into a barricade. But she was unarmed. They killed her. And apparently now, from, I mean, if you take the latest word, and the one that seems most incriminating to them and the latest is the most likely to be true, she was getting out of her car. Unarmed. And they blew her away. That's murder. Can't do that. These men aren't gods. They're just the local security force. You can't delegate to them the right to murder people because you don't have the right to murder people. They only have the right to use violence in defense of life. Not to punish someone who they don't like because she made them chase her a few blocks. And you notice how that one's just gone. That was the biggest deal in the world for a minute back when she was a terrorist, armed shooter, and the Congress was being protected and the White House was being protected from her. And then it came out she was just some lady and they murdered her. Meh. Well, whatever. The only thing, again, notable about the cops in D.C. killing a black person in this case was they killed her in the white part of town. Otherwise, they would have just said that, oh, yeah, she had a 38 or whatever, right? And then remember this guy, the 107-year-old man that they couldn't figure out a way to de-escalate this thing other than throw grenades in his house and shoot at him. And by the way, there were no kidnappees or hostages or anything like that. He had pulled a gun on the landlady. I'm sure she didn't do anything to pick that fight. And maybe he was just out of his head. He's 107 years old, whatever. He pulled a gun on her, but she got out of there. He was alone in the house. And come out with your hands up, or we're going to wait here until you take a nap. Wasn't good enough for these cops. They went in there like Gestapo stormtroopers of death of the Nazi party, and they went in there and they murdered him. They murdered him. Oh, boo-hoo, he said Nazi. Oh, but don't you know that this is the land between America and Mexico? And so if a cop kills somebody, a 107-year-old man, then you just may not ever make a comparison to the lawless murderers of Nazi Germany. Even though that was the whole point. Right? That was the one silver lining of World War II. out of 60 million people killed, there was one silver lining, which was never again. We're going to take the lesson here that, no, we don't tolerate totalitarianism. And we don't tolerate aggressive warfare. Not anymore. Not after this. That's the whole thing. Was we get to have that to compare things to. No, the difference is the Gestapo would have shown their faces to the whole neighborhood as they murdered the 107-year-old man. They wouldn't have hidden like cowards behind body armor and ski masks. They would have shown their faces and then they would have gone in there and killed them. You know, like an American sheriff. 107-year-old man fought in World War II. I think. Yeah, probably. Conscripted, I'm sure, to go fight for freedom against the Nazis. And then this one isn't a murder, but it's just the same thing for you to understand. And maybe, you know what, you're not a political person, you're just a regular kind of person, and you don't usually hear this kind of radical talk and whatever. Jeez, that kid just sat down and jotted down that many examples of police murdering innocent people in the last... Jeez, they all must have done something to warrant execution, right? I got some cognitive dissonance here. I saw on TV that the government created me so that I could love it. And then when I die, they'll let me go to heaven, you know? Especially if they're the ones who kill me, I think. I saw that on Law and Order. The grace of government. But did you see the one, and I think this is old and it's back in the news because of the court case or whatever. The autistic kid in Riverside, California, in the Inland Empire there, entrapped at his government school by an undercover cop. Into getting some weed for the undercover cop. Not that this kid sold weed. He was just some kid that they targeted. He was the weakest person. You know, taking a page from the FBI trying to find a terrorist to, blow up the Brooklyn Bridge. Well, what we'll do is we'll find the slowest kid at the bookstore. And we'll trick him into saying he'll do it. And that'll be good enough for a conviction. Anyway, in this case, they just targeted the autistic kid, tricked him into scoring a misdemeanor amount of weed for the undercover cop, and then they set about destroying his helpless autistic life. And the parents are suing, saying the school sold their kid out, man. The school's job is to protect their kid. And I'm saying you ought to sue yourself. You turn your kid over to the government, to your enemies. You turn your helpless, autistic son over to the government. You know what you ought to do? You ought to go out to the workshop and you ought to cut off your own hand as punishment. So that you'll never forget. Why you don't have a hand. That time that you turn your government over to undercover cops to entrap and persecute. Don't blame the school. It was you. Well, these people took me hostage. But I trust them to go, take off with my kid. You know, they're going to educate him. They're going to teach his autistic brain how to read and write and be a good, productive citizen. Because that's what matters in America, is being productive. You know, your life is owed to everyone else. Right? So anyway, these horrible criminal parents negligently turn their child over to the public school system for his education. Unbelievable. How could you do that to your own children? And now the kid's in court, man. This minor kid is in court as a drug dealer. And then that reminded me of this. There's a new article. I guess there's a new movie about the Memphis Three. These three kids who were convicted of killing three small children. These guys were young adults. Convicted of murdering three or four small children. They 150% did not do it. But they were the local Metallica kids in town. And the article I read about, it was a review of the movie. is at Truth Out, and it was about, I think it was at Truth Out, and it was about how, look, what really went on here was it was in the interest of the judge, and it was in the interest of the prosecutor, and it was in the interest of the cops to pretend that these guys did it, okay? Justice, the truth, was never their interest. They had a separate set of incentives for doing what they did. And all their incentives made them do, or not made them, but lent toward them doing the wrong thing, not the right thing. Because, see, simply, the American justice system is not necessarily about truth and justice. And I'm sorry to be simple and patronizing, but there are some moms listening maybe right now who just, you know, you watch Matlock, and when Matlock calls him out, the prosecutor drops the charges, right? The prosecutor says to the judge, "Judge, I hereby petition for a dismissal of all charges against this poor defendant who I accidentally mistakenly indicted because I believed he'd done something wrong, but now that I know the truth." But that's not real life. Real life is bury them under the prison. Who cares? They're just human beings. It's not like they're government employees with a natural right to their own life or something. They're just citizens. Nobodies. They might as well be Iranians. They might as well be Palestinians. You know, born to be crushed. And these guys, one of them was sentenced to death. The other's life in prison. Their entire lives destroyed. The cops, they didn't care at all. They were happy to destroy the lives of innocent kids and lock them in cages like animals forever. They didn't care. And they don't care that to this day, the person who actually butchered, I forget now how many, 3 or 5 small children got away with murder. That they are his accomplices. They are the accessories after the fact. The judge, the prosecutor, the jurors who took the responsibility on themselves to convict these innocent kids. And that's just one case. And that's just a case where because they were heavy metal kids or whatever, it had a little narrative to it. It had an alternative culture kind of a thing that documentarians could bite onto. But out of the millions of Americans, literally plural millions of Americans in prison right now, what percent of them are completely innocent? Never mind bogus trumped up offenses against state power and whatever. Never mind, you know, bogus non-crime crimes. But how many of them are wholly innocent? What percentage are wholly innocent? And how many tens of thousands of people is that? Hundreds of thousands? Oh, man. Look how long it took me to get through that. I better go faster. We'll be right back in just a sec after this stuff. Good stuff, actually. Great stuff. Hello, dead air. Come on, man. Uh-oh, apparently I screwed up my timing on this one. Oops. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Now that I think about it, there was one outro tune that was only 20 seconds. I got it in a 30-second spot there. Oops. Yeah, whatever. It's live radio, man. Little things happen. I'll fix it. All right. So listen, I have a point here, which is stop trusting and loving the government so much, please. I mean, I don't know. You know what it is? It's a cognitive dissonance thing. All day on TV, or, well, every evening on TV anyway, it's all TV shows about how wonderful the cops are, about how great they are. And usually, in fact, the lesson is that they have to break the law themselves in order to really protect you well, you know? And then you see in the news that, geez, cops kill innocent people every day. There's 150 to 200 SWAT raids, a special weapons assault team raids on American citizens every day. That's not hostage situations at the bank. That's right-wing paramilitary death squads, man. That's what our government would call them if they were, well, our government's allies in any other country. If our CIA was backing them, that's what our State Department would call them while, you know, trying to maintain deniability. And, you know, I don't know. I'm a libertarian, and I'm not a big believer in democracy, but I do think that it is possible for the American people within the American system to push back. I think, you know, we were pleasantly surprised, weren't we, to see just how well it worked on Syria? Obama must have called Putin begging and crying, please come up with a way out of this for me. The American people, it was just, the American people stopped a war. Just the other day, man. And, you know, Radley Balco and Will Grigg and Cop Block and people like that who are doing this great police work, I think that we can get, and especially Balco is getting op-eds in the Wall Street Journal and in your local newspaper and stuff. I think it's possible, and there are huge interest groups against it. But, it is possible to create a consensus among the American people that, hey, all this military to domestic police transfers has gotten way out of hand. No more tanks, no more machine guns. It's, you know, back to Mayberry with you guys. Terrorist schmerist, drug schmugs, put down your machine gun. It'll be 38 revolvers like the old days for the lot of you. We can do that. We have to insist on that. Or we will be slaves. We will live in a totalitarian state. You know, if just 10 or 15 years ago, mid-90s, you were told it would be this bad, you would say, nah, because they would have stopped that. There'd have been some pushback. Anyway, I don't know. Doesn't have to be this way. That's all I'm trying to say. I don't necessarily know the solution. Maybe you're, you know, one of these people who's good at networking. Maybe you can put together a, hey, let's roll this back thing. How about I have an idea for model legislation. This isn't Iraq. Model legislation. That's what we'll call the bill. The This Isn't Iraq bill. And no, you will not do your armored patrols in our neighborhoods and kick in our doors and treat us like Fallujans. Hell, it's a supermajority consensus now that we never should have even done the Fallujans that way. We're going to let them do that to us now? Is nobody going to draw a line at these cops killing first and asking questions later? Every day in this country, it seems like another innocent shot dead. I don't know. Well, anyway, I think it's a problem. Wait a minute. Not I think it's a problem. It's an objective fact that it's a problem. I'm just simply observing it and noting it, passing it on to you. Okay, good. All right, there's a new report about how Obama is worse on dealing with the press than any president since Nixon, and it's got complaints from all different kinds, even the worst sycophant reporters complaining about the clampdown in the press. And there's all kinds of, I think, serious implications here. It's not just reporters that you hate anyway whining about their own job or whatever, but this is an evolution of the way things work in the former so-called free, open society here to the degree that it ever was. It's a ratchet effect kind of a thing, and I very much doubt the next president will be much more open, if you understand what I mean. This isn't really a story just about Obama. It's a story about the government's openness with the media. Let's see, Syria we could put off because Pfeffer's coming on in just a few minutes to talk about Syria. I mentioned this before. I'm going to really try hard again to get a hold of Nick Turse. He's a very productive and very busy guy, and I know that doing this show isn't his top priority, but I'm going to keep bugging him because I want Nick Turse, if not Bob Dreyfus, to come on the show and talk about this thing they did at The Nation about Afghan casualties. It's a whole thing, man, and they got a whole interactive database and this, that, the other thing, four or five different sidebars. It's really important, thenation.com. And you don't have to agree with them on their stupid smellfare policy or whatever it is, but Bob Dreyfus and Nick Turse both are badass journalists, and this is about civilian casualties in the Afghan war, and so there. Go and look at it, no matter what your persuasion there, no matter what you think of The Nation in general. Man, that's some serious worth looking at for you, I think, if I can call them that, and I can, so I just did. The Libya thing, maybe I'll save that for a minute. Did I read the headline right at antiwar.com? There was a bombing in every provincial capital in Pakistan yesterday. Big doings afoot in Pakistan. I need to get a hold of Anand Gopal. I think he's the guy that I know who's best on that. Yeah, blam, look, every Pakistani provincial capital bombed, 12 killed. The hell? How many different provincial capitals is that? Four or five or six or something, right? I don't know. Here, what's the clock? Okay, I got just 1 minute. Maybe we're going to come back and talk about Libya and Egypt in the last segment of the show. And maybe we'll have this lady on the show. I want to get her on the show. She did this great thing, man. Rachel Levinson is her name. Levinson Waldman. Everybody's got to have their middle name hyphenated and all this, their former maiden, this and that. BrennanCenter.org. BrennanCenter.org. And Rachel Levinson Waldman has done this killer thing. Connor Frieden, what's it you call it, over at The Atlantic is right. This is the single best overview of them tapping your life. It's called What the Government Does with Americans' Data. BrennanCenter.org. What the Government Does with Americans' Data. Look at this. Seriously, we're going to talk about this later on in the show, too. But this is weekend reading for you, for sure. I'll post it, too. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. The jobless rate in America keeps climbing. Food stamps and other social welfare spending continue to increase at an alarming rate. And the only thing that's kept this whole so-called recovery going at all is the Federal Reserve's inflationary printing press. Seems like 2008 might have just been a rehearsal for the financial crisis still to come. So now let me talk to you about this great video by Dr. Martin Weiss from moneyandmarkets.com. The video spells out how this disaster will affect you and create enormous financial opportunities if you know how to recognize a true diamond in the rough. Weiss shows when stocks have crashed and even gives the names of the biggest banks that are most likely to fail. Before you invest $1, take the time to watch this new video. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. Learn from the experts how to evaluate these opportunities and start making better informed decisions that will lead to a better return on your investments. That's Dr. Martin Weiss at crisis16.com. All right, all right. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Website is scotthorton.org. You can find my full interview archive there. More than 3,000 interviews now, going back to 2003 at scotthorton.org. And join us up in the chat room, man. It's scotthorton.org/chat. Got a few people hanging out in there today. I don't know if anybody's doing much talking yet, but join up, scotthorton.org/chat. And now to our first guest. It's our old friend John Pfeffer from Foreign Policy and Focus, the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me back, Scott.
Well, it's good to talk to you again. And I guess I was reading that you went traveling all around Eastern Europe and writing all kinds of things, but I didn't get a chance to catch up on all that. But maybe I will get a chance to, and then I can interview you about all that. Do you want to tell us about your trip?
Sure. I was on an Open Society Foundation fellowship, and basically I was tracking down the people that I talked to in 1989 and 1990. So
wow.
I talked to about 250 people, various activists and people who later became, you know, politicians or remained activists. And I found quite a few of them, and I sat down and talk with them to find out what happened to them over the last 23 years, what happened to their countries, and what happened to many of the big hopes that people had that Eastern Europe would kind of go off in an interesting new direction.
Cool. And so is there a way where you can, like for each person, you can see their old interview and their new one, that kind of thing?
Yep. If you go to my website, which is johnpfeffer.com, you just click on the Eastern Europe part, and you can scroll through. There are about 110 interviews up there right now, and I would say about a third of them come with the previous interview as well.
Okay, great. Man, that's so cool. I sure hope I can get a chance to go through that soon. I got to read Max Blumenthal all this weekend. I know that. all right. So listen, Foreign Policy and Focus, that's where you write a lot of things, fpif.org, as well as your own site, johnpfeffer.com. And I wanted to talk with you about this one, or I wanted you to talk with us about it. Syria, what's next? And first of all, you have a great retelling of it, and I just love this part of the story so much, I want to hear it again. Tell us, John, all about how the American people rose up as one and screamed no and stopped the war. Wasn't that great?
Well, as as you know, the war did not take place, and that's a good thing. And for that, we should all be very, very happy. The reason why that happened, well, I mean, certainly there was a lot of public, shall we say, apathy, a lot of public opposition to the war. The polls indicated, and the president and Congress were reading those polls, indicated that a large majority of the American population did not want to have any kind of intervention in Syria, whether it was boots on the ground or missile attacks. And but I think that the president was not only looking at the polls, he was looking at the very difficult prospect of launching attack and having any kind of success whatsoever, and the potential spillover, the potential consequences of the attack in terms of what would happen in the region, what would happen in terms of U.S. standing with Iran, Israel's position in the region. So there are a lot of reasons why I think the president ultimately decided that he was not enthusiastic about this attack, so unenthusiastic, in fact, that he decided he would go to Congress to get a mandate. Now, that would perhaps be the last place that you would imagine the president would go to get a mandate. I mean, it would be more difficult to get a mandate from Congress than it would be even from the Security Council at the UN. This is an institution that has blocked the president on virtually every one of his initiatives over the last year. And I think it was clear that the president knew that he was going to basically get the big NO from Congress, and that's a reflection of basically his reluctance to even follow through on what had been a promise.
Yeah. Okay, well, I don't care. I'm still taking credit for the American people. But yeah, you're right. I know. It was such a fool's errand that even in Washington, D.C., some significant segment of the population there recognized what a disaster it could be and at least, you know, how little good it could possibly do. And I think
absolutely.
You're right that he went to Congress in a way saying, you know, hold me back, guys, kind of a thing, you know.
Exactly. But if you turn it around and if you imagine that, say, 70% of the American public supported an attack on Syria, that would, of course, have made an entirely different political calculation in Washington, different calculation for the president, different calculation for Congress. They would have been responding to an entirely different situation. So I don't want to discount, you know, the anti-war sentiment or the anti-war organizing, because all you have to do is flip it around and you'll see that it would have been entirely different if the numbers had been different.
Right. All right, so now, we can get back to why it would have been such a bad deal, but today's news is that the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has won the Nobel Prize. And then do I understand it right that they're the ones who right now are attempting to dismantle Syria's chemical weapons?
Yeah, well, I mean, we haven't gotten to the dismantlement phase, but this is...
Well, a little bit, right? They said they're drilling holes and filling things with concrete and hacking things with hacksaws, I guess.
Well, we're getting, you know, some cooperation from the Syrian government. We're getting some information about the size of the chemical arsenal, and you know, they've got a big deadline. You know, they're supposed to really start in earnest in November and finish sometime in 2014, and this is not going to be easy. I mean, this is even in the best of circumstances. Even if we were talking about dismantling, you know, chemical weapons, you know, on a holiday resort, you know, it would be challenging to meet that deadline. But we're talking about in the middle of a civil war, and that's never going to be easy to do anything, much less a complicated endeavor like dismantling an entire chemical weapons arsenal.
But you know, I've read some pretty optimistic stuff about it. I think it was a McClatchy piece that said that, you know, almost all of these are binary type weapons where they're not nearly as dangerous before they're mixed, and there's apparently a pretty big quantity of them, proportion of them. Was one chemical is an alcohol-based thing where they said you could just pour it all out in the desert and just evaporate away, and that's half of the weapon right there. And you know, so it sounded like they at least were pretty optimistic. They were talking in the newspaper saying, you know, we think we're going to be able to do this. I don't know how different, you know, what they have is compared to, I know in Anniston, Alabama, they have the world's gnarliest incinerator to try to get rid of America's chemical weapons, and it doesn't work all that well. It's not quite hot enough. They've had problems and that kind of thing. So maybe that's just because the Americans have a lot worse chemicals than Assad ever did, or what? I don't know. VX versus something.
I don't think the challenge is so much, you know, once the chemical weapons are identified and then the dismantlement begins. I think the challenge is determining that all the chemical weapons have been identified. That I think, you know, it's always going to be a question whether some have been hidden away. I mean, you know, these are not huge, you know, enormous missiles with warheads that, I mean, as you point out, some of them are quite simple, and they could be in a room somewhere that is hidden underground or wherever.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's also concern that some have somehow been taken over by other non-governmental forces, shall we say. So that's also a concern. So I think that's going to be the challenge, not so much the dismantlement itself, but really determining the size, the scope, and the location of all of the arsenal.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now back to the war and the red line and all that. I guess, well, there was a New York Times story said that Obama never meant to say red line in the first place. In fact, it seemed like maybe they had discussed and said, like, whatever you do, don't say red line. And then that was, he just kind of blundered like George Bush, catapult the propaganda, and just accidentally said the wrong thing kind of thing. And so he was trying to back down from that. But it's hard to back down from a term like red line. That's something that John McCain can latch onto and repeat over and over and, you know, interesting for TV presenters and that kind of stuff. So it's hard for him to back down from it. But now that he has, and he's made this deal with the Russians about the chemical weapons and, you know, the United Nations and all this to get rid of the chemical weapons, he's basically given up regime change and saying, go ahead and stay at least for a little while to Assad, because he needs Assad to give up the chemical weapons, right?
That's right. Well, you know, the commitment on the part of the Obama administration to regime change in Syria has always been, shall we say, a little half-hearted. You know, in some sense, Assad represents some form of stability in the region. I mean, this is in part why the Israeli government was not enthusiastic to see signs of crisis within Syria. Obviously, Israel has had plenty of problems with Syria in the past, but Assad was someone they had been dealing with, and he was a known quantity, whereas some of the other forces bubbling up there in Syria were not known quantities, and their willingness, so to speak, to negotiate with Israel was a question mark. I think the United States government looks at the Syrian situation in much the same way. Pentagon, State Department, their primary interest is stability. They want a predictable situation. They want a government that they may not love, but at least they can deal with, they can negotiate with, can have some degree of certainty how it's going to act. And that's the case with Assad. Okay, he might be, you know, working with the Russians. He might be, you know, supporting all sorts of nefarious activities around the world, but he is a known quantity. Certainly that's not the case with a number of the actors in the Syrian opposition. So regime change is always a tricky issue, and obviously the Obama administration is very cognizant of what happened in Iraq, not all that enthusiastic about what happened in Libya. So all of this experience adds up to a big question mark when it comes to regime change in Syria.
Yeah. Well, you think they could have learned a lesson from their failure in Libya?
Well, you know, on the one hand, there is the geopolitical spillover, the problems that have been taking place in Libya. All of that, I'm sure, is foremost in the president's mind. On the other hand, let's remember that the president, in part, was responding to a particular political crisis within the United States, in which he was receiving an enormous amount of pressure from Congress, but even more so, pressure from European allies. And from that point of view, regardless of what happened in Libya, I think the administration feels like what it did was, in some sense, successful. It managed to prevent what it argued was a humanitarian crisis, what was likely to be a human rights catastrophe, and removed someone who was pretty unpredictable. Okay, so the consequences have been miserable, and, you know, that should be a lesson that the administration should learn. However, I think from its point of view, the strategy it undertook in those moments managed to satisfy a number of conditions that they felt they had to satisfy, both domestically and externally.
Yeah, especially domestically. You know, I was interviewing Ariel Sharon's comatose half a corpse yesterday, and it was saying that, oh yeah, the war in Libya was a great success. Thank you very much. That was number three on my list. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And so then, and you refer to this, well, actually, Now that I'm hovering over it, this is U.S. News. I don't know if this is a reference to the same thing or not. I was thinking of the New York Times article about how the Israeli position is let them kill each other. And what's funny about that is the policy is not let them kill each other. It's help them kill each other, right? You know, make it worse and worse and worse, but keep it a stalemate. They even said that in the Washington Post, and they weren't even shy about it. They go, well, what we want to do, we want to arm them up so that this horrible, massive Bay of Pigs massacre takes as long as possible before we stab them in the back and leave them all completely high and dry to be killed eventually. Like, really? God dang, guys.
We have a precedent for that, and that was the Iran-Iraq War. I mean, certainly the United States, you know, it was formally supporting Saddam in those days, supporting Iraq in order to weaken Iran as much as possible. But then, of course, as we discovered with the Iran-Contra affair, we were secretly supporting the Iranians as well, arming both sides. And I think the idea at that time was, hey, a pox on both those houses. If they can fatally weaken one another, that's to America's advantage in the region. Now, of course, you know, what happened was entirely different. They did, you know, stagger each other for years and years, but both of them emerged from that with plenty of armaments left over. And I think that's the lesson we should learn from the Syria situation as well. Even if we were to arm both sides, and we are largely, you know, supporting the opposition here, of course, but even if we were to arm both sides, I don't think that would lead to the kind of result that, you know, that these people are calling for, in which they basically all kill each other off. That is not what happens in these situations.
I wonder if you think it's possible that they could do another redirection and maybe not back both sides, but switch sides back to Assad. After all, George Bush paid Assad to torture people for us for years and years. He's a Baathist secular fascist dictator partner in the war on terror against Al-Qaeda, who now we're the ones who switch sides, not him, you know, kind of thing. But so, you know, the LA Times has this thing, U.S. fears radical Islamists could take root in Syria. We hear the same kind of propaganda about Libya, and David Vine is coming up on the show to talk about the buildup in Italy for further intervention in Libya. And it's just like, I was trying to warn them. I'm sure you were probably on the show trying to warn them, too, before they even declared the no-fly zone in Libya, that once you do this and get a regime change there, then the policy is obvious that you're not going to be able to let the guys that you're fighting for win, because they're a bunch of Mujahideen veterans of the Iraq War, for Christ's sake. And so that just means there's going to have to be further and further and further intervention to determine the future there. You know, the worse of a failure it is, the more of an excuse they have to intervene.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think, you know, the possibility of a redirect, I think it might, as I argue in the article, it might be a road that passes through Tehran. I mean, this is the kind of big issue on the plate for the U.S. government right now, and that is the possible rapprochement with Tehran. This is perhaps the most promising development in years. People might remember that in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, the United States and Iran actually worked very closely together because, of course, Iran was not enthusiastic, shall we say, about the Taliban in Afghanistan, and were happy to help the United States dislodge the Taliban. The Iranians were as surprised as many people around the world when George W. Bush included Iran in the axis of evil, and that, as Ryan Crocker has said, was one word that changed history. That there was a possibility for rapprochement in those days, but that axis of evil State of the Union speech in 2002 basically scotched that. So it's been more than a decade, and now we have a different leader in Iran. We have the possibility of some negotiations going forward on the nuclear question, and as importantly, some cooperation possibly as well on Syria. So I don't see necessarily a redirect that would have the United States suddenly kind of deciding, hey, you know, we like Assad after all, but we might see some kind of deal with the United States and Iran working together, maybe to find some kind of modus operandi in Syria that would allow Assad to leave, but leave behind much of his apparatus.
Yeah, well, I keep plagiarizing the Leverett's on the go to China thing, and I forget now whether they make this point about the Nixon goes to China. You got to just go and start with let's be friends and then work out the details from there, because if you try to work on any one set of details, the war party's going to screw you up by linking it to something else and whatever, and they always find a way to sabotage it kind of thing. But my point about it is that going to China is what made it okay for Nixon to lose Vietnam. The whole point of Vietnam was, oh no, we can't let the Red Menace spread throughout Asia there, but oh geez, I guess if the Red Chinese are our friends, then it doesn't matter if the Vietnamese are communists or not, and so we can go ahead and lose that war that we can't possibly win without atomic weapons, and so bye. And then, so my thing is, instead of having to take the Sunni side in the Sunni-Shia civil war in the region that the United States created with the Iraq war invasion, where we fought on the Shia side, as you just said, we could just do the go to China thing and make friends with the entire Shiite crescent, whatever. I know they have to divide and conquer and have one enemy or another, they think, but it seems to me like they could just be friends with everybody. You know, the State Department. Let's be friends with everyone.
Well,
why not?
Well, could be.
I mean, why do we have to force all these guys to kill each other all the time?
I would certainly endorse that, but you know, from the State Department's point of view and the Pentagon's point of view, you know, there is an overarching reason for a rapprochement. And the rapprochement with China, of course, had less to do with the Vietnam War and much more to do with isolating Russia as much as possible. So it was to drive a wedge between the two principal communist powers in the world. If we were to, for instance, have a rapprochement with Iran, well, then there would be some other overriding geopolitical reason. It might be to secure our kind of anti-China alliance, for instance. I mean, we've been putting together as closely as possible a kind of ring around China, a ring of our allies that essentially contains China's influence. Certainly Iran could be, you know, a puzzle piece in that. So, but I don't really expect the United States to basically take what had been Turkey's foreign policy over the last decade, which was to be friends with everybody. Turkey's in a particularly vulnerable place in the world, and that was the reason it decided to adopt that particular foreign policy. The U.S. has unfortunately pursued its exceptionalist foreign policy tradition, and that has meant for the most part that it doesn't feel it needs to be friends with everybody, and in fact can be extremely selective about who it wants to be friendly with around the world.
Yeah, boy, that is sad, isn't it, that there's the only way you could make the U.S. state could make friends with one of its enemies, that, face it, they're only our enemy because they declared independence from our empire. It's not like they picked this fight with us or anything. And the only way that we could ever really heal things is if we can somehow use them as a weapon against somebody else. You know, maybe we can forge an alliance between them and India and use them against Pakistan and China.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the kind of logic of geopolitics that permeates U.S. foreign policy. We have, for the most part, you know, a team of realists who make those calculations. Unfortunately, the kinds of idealists that we've had have not been the kind of idealists we necessarily like. I mean, George W. Bush and some of his neocon team were, of course, idealists in some respect as well, kind of defying the geopolitical logic in order, for instance, to so-called promote democracy around the world. So trying to fashion a new kind of logic for the State Department and for U.S. foreign policy, well, I mean, it's something we've been trying to do with Foreign Policy in Focus for 15 years, you know, putting forward the kind of arguments that we believe are necessary for a kind of multilateral, peaceful, economically just and sustainable foreign policy for the United States. We've seen some progress in some places around the world, but I can't say that there's anybody inside the State Department that has adopted our platform en masse.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, John. You think a libertarian could sell non-interventionism to liberal internationalists? A libertarian like me could sell non-interventionism, just hands off, forget about it, no more collective security, no more none of that, in place of a kind and just and multilateral foreign policy like you just described that you can't seem to get either?
Uh-huh. Well, I think there is some support for that, and there always has been some support for that within U.S. political elites that has stood in kind of distinction to liberal internationalism. But the problem is that at the moment the United States is so embedded in liberal international institutions, whether we're talking about political institutions like the United Nations or economic institutions that are, I'm not just talking about the World Trade Organization, I'm talking about a myriad of economic institutions that set the regulations for trade and for economic cooperation. Because the United States is embedded in those institutions, it's relatively difficult to put forward a strict, isolationist position. On the narrow question, however, of non-military intervention, I think we might have more success because we can make the economic argument. We can say, okay, we can be part of the UN, we can be part of NATO even, we can be part of these economic institutions. However, economically speaking, we're bankrupting the United States by having basically an aggressive, forward-based military position that encourages military intervention, that encourages the kinds of involvement that we've seen over the last 50 years. Using that economic argument, I think we could have a little bit more success, especially right now given the budget constraints in Washington. So yes, on that narrow question of non-intervention, non-military intervention, I think we can be successful in basically arguing down the positions of the liberal internationalists.
There you go. All right, well, listen, I'm sorry that we can't keep going, but we're all out of time. But it's good to talk to you again, and I am going to catch up on your journey there through Eastern Europe, catching up with your old interviewees from a generation back at the end of the Cold War. That must be really something. I can't wait to look at that. It's John Pfeffer, everybody, FPIF.org and JohnPfeffer.com. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back in a sec with David Vine, y'all.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me, you heard it here. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much for listening. check out my website, scotthorton.org. It's new and improved. Got the chat room built right into the page there at scotthorton.org/chat. Got 3,000 interviews going back to 2003. We got the old stress blog moved over to the new site. Looking theme sort of a thing going on. And it's still a work in progress, but we're making progress. Very good there, scotthorton.org. And then you can also check me out on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. If you like checking out things on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. All right. Next up is our friend David Vine. He's the author of Island of Shame. Man, Island of Shame is right. It's more like the whole world except that island worth of shame. Welcome back to the show, David. How are you doing?
I'm doing real well. Thanks for having me back.
Very good to have you here. And I should say you write for TomDispatch.com oftentimes. I should not pound on the table while I say that. You write for TomDispatch.com, and thank goodness for that. And recently, you wrote this article about U.S. military buildup in Italy. It's a good starting point for this conversation anyway. That was really kind of mind-blowing. Maybe this isn't that thoughtful or original or anything, but it made me think that we need to start calling Italy Airstrip 2. Like out of 1984, where England is merely Airstrip 1, the former nuclear air base of the American Empire, you know?
Absolutely. No, you know, Britain has been referred to as the unsinkable aircraft carrier in was during the Cold War and has more or less remained that with some reductions in the post-Cold War era. But Italy is rapidly and in some ways taking its place as a aircraft carrier or runway for U.S. military intervention far beyond Europe.
Well, so what's the problem? Pirates in the Mediterranean there?
I think the military in some ways doesn't even know, but they want to have increased capabilities of intervention from Africa to the Middle East to the Balkans and Eastern Europe and Italy in the minds of military and other officials is the perfect location from which to base these sorts of intervention forces and to launch future interventions.
You know, I read this article in defensenews.com, and it's funny, the paragraph, it's so redundant, it's terribly written, but basically, you can't quote it without sounding like a fool, but what it says is that the Army, after getting kicked out of Iraq and winding down in Afghanistan, they're looking for ways to stay globally engaged. In other words, they've got nothing to do. So they form this Dagger Brigade, and they're going, the Dagger Brigade, you know, like stab somebody in the back in a cruel kind of underhanded manner, the Dagger Brigade, and they're going to invade Africa. And so look out, Africans, you're going to get killed. Because here comes the Dagger Brigade, because they're looking for ways to stay globally engaged. Because what else are they going to do? Sit around twiddling their thumbs, raping each other all day?
I have to go look for that article.
Well, there's your key words, man. And it's, you know, read it and weep. You know what I mean? It's out of the mouths of babes. They don't know that they're not supposed to say, well, you see, our bureaucratic institutional interest is to find people to kill. And so we're on the lookout.
Yeah, I think for quite a while, the military, especially in Europe, beginning with the Army, has been looking for things to do, for reasons to be there. We're now, you know, more than 20 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, and we still have tens of thousands of troops in Europe. Those numbers have come down significantly in recent years, especially. But as many point out, you know, what is the Army doing in Europe? And increasingly, Africa has become the answer. No country in Africa is willing to host the headquarters of the U.S. Africa Command to date. So Italy and Germany have basically become the headquarters for the Africa Command as a whole and for different components for each of the armed services.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, if they were trying to come up with a coherent narrative about what they're doing there, they sure don't have one when they're fighting the Mujahideen that really they created accidentally. As a matter of blowback, in Somalia, they fought for the Mujahideen in Libya and then against them again in Mali, you know, and then chasing Joseph Kony around and all of this. They're just making stuff up, obviously.
Well, I think one of the reasons I'm quite concerned is that the military is looking to get increasingly engaged, as you put it, or in using their words, which means intervening increasingly in conflicts around Africa and elsewhere. That the military and the U.S. public, for that matter, and politicians know very little about. I think we've already seen with the two recent raids in Somalia and Libya that the raids have generated a significant anger and outrage, that the United States has violated the sovereignty of these two nations. And any supposed benefits of the two raids that one might be able to claim, I think, you know, very, very quickly might be outweighed by the anger and outrage and frankly, recruitment for forces that might wish to do the United States harm that have come about as a result of the raids.
Well, the prime minister was kidnapped the next day or two days later. So talk about blowback. I think it's more like backdraft, just blowing up right in your face. No secret about what happened here, you know?
No, I think that's exactly right. And whether you call it blowback or backdraft, because it's so immediate, I think the danger is that these sorts of interventions are going to create more of the insecurity and mayhem that they're supposedly designed to prevent.
Do you hear that, everybody? I'm coining a phrase. I was going to write an article about it, but it wasn't good enough, so I dropped it. But I'm going to get that term into circulation. Backdraft as the more immediate, less covert action-y version of blowback. All right, it worked on you, David.
I like it.
I'm carrying this thing through, man.
You should go with it.
All right. So now I'm going to be quiet for a long time in a row and let you describe what all you learned about the bases. And just go ahead and tell us how many Taco Bells they got and everything you know about the base buildup and how many soldiers and whatever. Did you talk to guys? Did they say what they're doing there? Whatever you got to say. Let's hear.
Sure. For about 4 years, I've been visiting Italy as part of research for a book about U.S. military bases abroad and their broad impacts. And Italy has been striking because just in those 4 years and actually beginning really at the beginning of the war on terror, Italy has seen this very significant buildup of forces and bases while at the very same time, we've been closing bases, especially in Germany, but closing bases around Europe. So at the time that we're closing bases and returning facilities to the government of Germany, and actually a few in Italy, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on new bases, new facilities in Italy. So we're seeing essentially a shift in the center of gravity for the U.S. military in Europe from Germany toward Italy. Germany still remains incredibly important for the U.S. military, for U.S. military strategy in Europe and globally, for that matter, with Ramstein Air Base and very large training facilities in the east of the former Western Germany. But Italy is come to assume increasing importance. And one of the bases in particular that I look at in this article at TimeDispatch.com is a new base in Vicenza, Italy, where the United States has actually maintained somewhere around six or more bases since the 1950s. The Army came to Congress in about 2006 and said, we need a new base. We need a new base because we have this combat brigade, the 173rd Combat Brigade, that's divided, it's split-based between Germany and Italy. And Congress proceeded to turn over about $310 million for a new base in Vicenza, and actually, in total, around $600 million for additional construction, as well as a new base around Vicenza, around what they call the Vicenza Military Community. And over the next several years, the space grew, and I had a chance to go visit multiple occasions, despite the tremendous opposition of local people in Vicenza, which is a city, smallish city near Venice. Despite massive local opposition and opposition around Italy, the Pentagon proceeded with the help of the Italian government to build this very significant new base. Now, the interesting thing that I point out in this article is that, flash forward to last spring, the Pentagon, the Army, they get the keys to the first building in this new base, place called Dal Molene, and they're within months of taking ownership over all the new buildings in the space. There are about 31 buildings. That same within weeks of getting the keys to the new base, the Army announces, well, the whole reason that we needed to build this new base to consolidate a brigade in Vicenza, actually, we're not going to consolidate in Vicenza. We're going to keep 2 of 6 battalions in Germany. So the whole justification for the new base, which was to consolidate a brigade in one place, they finally, you know, get $600 million, they get the base, they get the buildings for the base, and then they tell Congress and the American public, actually, we take it all back. We're not going to do what we said we're going to do, but we're going to keep the base, of course. So this, to me, was particularly shocking and outrageous, because on the face of it, it looks like the Army really never had any intention of consolidating in Vicenza in the first place, but just settled on a convenient justification that would pry loose hundreds of millions of dollars from Congress to get a new base where they wanted it.
Right. Yeah, that's what it always comes down to, it too. You know, you think about all the highfalutin rhetoric about saving innocent lives in Kosovo. Just go look at Camp Bondsteel, a picture from the air in your Google images, and you get the idea that maybe the whole war was fought just so that Halliburton could build that damn thing. Or I guess maybe there's a pipeline there they're pretending to guard or something.
Yeah, I think we always have to look at the complicated interests that benefit from base construction and the presence of bases, especially in Europe, where, you know, as many have pointed out, you know, what is the military doing there? Who are the enemies? Who is Italy's enemy? What enemies does Germany have these days? It's one of the
us. That's the whole thing. It's keeping the Germans from building up their own army again. Don't worry, you have us. You have NATO. We'll protect you. Don't rearm. Not seriously. You can arm yourself up enough to do what we say in Afghanistan, but please, that's all. I think that's basically the deal.
Yeah, that's one of the deals. Germany does have a quite significant army. But I think one of the U.S. Military officials I spoke to in Italy was quite frank about what the military is doing in Italy. He said, you know, we're not here to defend Italy. I'm sorry, Italy, he said. We're not here to defend you. We're here because we've decided we want to be here so that we can do other things.
Yeah. And you will sell us pizza and do as you're told. Yeah, that's the American attitude. I wonder why they call us the ugly Americans, you know? I have no idea, actually. Concentrate real hard and see if we can figure that out. All right, so now what's the big deal with this 200 Marines being sent there? Do you think, you know, Patrick Coburn was on the show yesterday, and, you know, he's making a great point, obviously, about the media and the Western elites just not paying one whit of attention whatsoever to Libya since the regime changed, since it's such a disaster. And then I was saying, yeah, but be careful what you wish for, because as soon as they start paying attention, they're going to start finding problems to solve over there, you know? And I just wonder what, since, you know, by any measure, that war has been such a disaster and has just turned the country into lawlessness and warring militias and whatever kind of thing. Do you think this 200 Marines being moved to Italy now, that just means it's just a matter of days before they're moved to Libya and this whole thing escalates further? Or, I mean, it's sort of like with the Syria thing. We just talked with John Pfeffer. They've got to know better at some point. You got to cut your losses and not. We were talking about Syria with him. At some point, you got to not do the George W. Bush thing to do, right?
Yeah, well, I think on the positive side of things, I think the days of large-scale interventions, at least for the time being, and I hope for the long-distance future as well, those days are over. I think Obama and others on Capitol Hill have no interest in sending large numbers of U.S. troops anywhere, and that I think that's a real victory on you know, the behalf of people who've opposed the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. But I think there is this danger that small-scale intervention is, in addition to the use of drones worldwide, that's the new or major part of the new U.S. military strategy going forward. But I think that the danger is that small-scale interventions, of course, can grow into much larger interventions, as we've seen, you know, going back to Vietnam and before.
Well, that's been my fear about Libya, that, you know, things could really deteriorate there fast. So then, you know, how many suicide bombings or how many ambassadors killed or how many Delta raids that go bad or whatever before they have to really escalate because of all the problems they've created? I mean, that's been their pattern for 100 years running now, you know?
Yeah, I think it is really dangerous.
Hey, let me hold you through this short break and then ask you more about bases around the world.
Sounds great.
Okay, great. It's David Vine, everybody. He's the author of Island of Shame, all about Diego Garcia and the plight of the Chagossians. You ought to take a look at that. And he writes for TomDispatch.com. We'll be right back after this. Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with David Vine. He's the author of Island of Shame, and we've been talking about his piece for Tom Dispatch, which also ran at antiwar.com, the Pentagon's Italian spending spree. And so in the book Island of Shame, which, like I was saying before the break there, is all about the Chagossians, who were they were kidnapped and forced marched across the sea, basically, by the Brits and the Americans, who stole their island home from them so that they could have a nuclear bomber base there at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. But in that same book, there's, I guess, it's a whole chapter, or maybe two or something, all about just America's global empire of bases. And of course, it's not the exact same kind of empire as the Roman Empire or the British one, but it is an empire in a great many ways. And when it comes to the power and influence achieved by just having a base in a country where, you know, like we're talking about, even closing it down, they don't want us to close it down just for their immediate economic interests and that kind of thing. They end up having, at last count that I saw, it was 1,000-something bases. I guess that number fluctuates, but there are, and I think the American people still don't really have their heads around this. The American government maintains 1,000 military bases outside of the country, all over the world, basically everywhere but Russia and China. We got a base right now. It's crazy. David, could you take us through? Could you try to paint a picture of the empire bases? And you know what? I don't mean to put a bunch of words in your mouth about to what degree that makes it an empire or not or whatever it is. You characterize it however you want. But also, count up the bases for us. Show us where they are and what they're for.
Sure. This collection of bases, empire bases, that you refer to is really unprecedented in not just U.S. history, but world history. It's a collection of bases that outstrips the largest collection that, as you mentioned, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, any previous empire or people ever collected. Bases have long been an important part of military strategy for empires, for countries, peoples. But the United States has amassed, really beginning in World War II, a collection that's global in scale and really quite remarkable in number. There are some bases, of course, it's important to point out, that go back to the 19th century, including Guantanamo Bay and others outside the continental U.S. But it was really in World War II that we see the explosion in this number of bases. The number, as you said, has fluctuated over time. Of course, during the Cold War, reached even higher levels, somewhere in the 2,000 to 3,000 or more range around the world. But, you know, again, more than two decades after the end of the Cold War, the United States still maintains hundreds of bases. It was easily over 1,000 until quite recently. It's a little unclear how many bases remain in Afghanistan. There were at one point 550 U.S. bases, and that's in addition to NATO bases. But now, the best numbers I've seen is that there remain about 100 bases in Afghanistan. So that takes the global total of U.S. bases outside the 50 states in Washington, D.C., that totals probably somewhere in the range of 800. Still a huge collection of bases, with major concentrations still in Europe, especially as we've been discussing, in Germany and Italy, but of course also in Japan and South Korea, throughout East Asia. There's all this talk of the Asia pivot right now. The United States has been pivoted to Asia for decades. We've had literally hundreds of bases in Japan, South Korea, Guam, and throughout East Asia, encircling both the Soviet Union during the Cold War, now Russia, and China. And now the Obama administration wants to move more military power in that direction. But it's also important to point out that there is a growing U.S. military presence in Africa proper. The U.S. military will only acknowledge the presence of one base that's in Djibouti on the continent of Africa, but it's clear that the military presence is growing, especially with the creation of small drone bases and small bases for special forces troops. Sometimes they're run by contractors. Generally, they're placed within host nation bases, so we're seeing a growth in the number of bases in Africa, also in Latin America. So at the same time that the United States is closing many bases in Afghanistan and some in Europe and elsewhere, we're seeing a growth in the number of bases, many of them these small, often referred to as lily pad bases. And there are a number of dangers with that, this strategy, including the getting involved in conflicts that we don't know anything about, as we've discussed. But also there's the potential, of course, for a small base to become something quite a bit larger, and that's exactly what we saw in Diego Garcia. It was pitched to Congress in the late 60s, early 70s as an austere communications facility. Now it's a multi-billion-dollar base. So I think we shouldn't be fooled by the creation of bases if they're just referred to as lily pad bases or cooperative security locations. Those bases can become much larger and be the beginning of a much larger investment and involvement of U.S. military power.
And then at the same time, though, in the book you quote him talking about, and I guess this is just the Air Force, saying, well, we can rule the world from Guam and Diego Garcia by 2015. We don't need all these lily pad bases all over Eurasia because they cause us problems. I mean, they're recognizing the problem of blowback and backdraft and all this great stuff, and they're recognizing that, you know, it'd be easier if we just threaten everybody with our hydrogen bombs from our air bases, and I guess, you know, tungsten rods from God.
Yeah, well, I think there are a few things to be said about that. First, you know, as we're trying to understand U.S. military strategy and make sense of it and how it changes in the world, we shouldn't think or assume that it's all logical. And of course, the U.S. military, and let alone the whole national security bureaucracy, it's huge. And there are competing interests and different views and different strategies going on at once that aren't necessarily coherent or logical. So you do have some people in the Air Force who say, you know, we don't need all these little bases around the world. Just give us, you know, three huge bases, Guam, Diego Garcia, maybe one or two in the States, and we can rule the world. But meanwhile, you know, there are people in the Army and the Air Force, the Navy, of course, who want far more bases, and especially the Army in places like Africa and the Marines to a lesser extent, who are exploring the creation of these smaller bases. So you have multiple strategies going on at the same time.
Yeah. All right, I'm sorry, we're all out of time. We got to go, but thank you very much, Dave. Appreciate your time on the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
All right, everybody, that's David Vine. He's associate professor of anthropology. Hey, everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. Nah, it's too quiet. I thought maybe I'd like this song here, but... Nah, I don't think so. Need something where somebody's hitting a drum harder, you know, bang, bang on a drum. All right, well, we'll fix that for next week. Anyway, hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. This is my show. So, I read this thing by Dennis Prager. Okay, I didn't. I just saw the headline. He's a right-wing radio show host, AM guy. So he wrote this thing for the National Review about, yeah, we're the leaders of the world. We are the global police. You're damn right. We have to be because we're the most best global leader police people around to have. And anybody else in this position would be way worse. And so it's great. And I was just wanting to point out that America backed Hitler before America fought Hitler. And America backed the Soviet Union to fight Hitler before the giant Cold War against the Soviet Union. America backed Iran before making an enemy out of Iran. America backed Saddam Hussein in Iraq to contain Iran. America backed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. The Mujahideen who became Al-Qaeda when we occupied Saudi Arabia in order to attack Iraq and stayed. And now after the war in the second war or the third act of America's campaign of genocide against the Iraqis, we've destabilized every country in the region. Now we got Mujahideen who've gone home to Libya and Syria, who have fought wars for regime change that America's back in the Sunni-based insurgency in these. Back to the days of the Ronald Reagan years and backing the Mujahideen. In this case, against the Shiites. Instead of the Soviets. So, yeah, I guess you could argue that America is the global police. But, at least for me, I hate cops. And I think that they're horrible. And I think they should not be cops. How about that? In fact, I like recommending a great article by Anthony Gregory called Against Police Socialism. From every person's ability to each according to his security needs, huh? Why? Why in the world would you have socialism in your security services any more than you want to have socialism in your produce? Makes no sense, man. And you can apply that same principle on the global level. Yeah, America is a Keystone Cop. And the thing of it is it ain't all harmless like, you know, World Police, which is a hilarious movie, by the way, especially the director's cut. God dang, man, you make my side hurt from laughing so hard. Well, I never saw it in the theater. I saw the director's cut on DVD the first time I ever saw it. And I was like, man, are you kidding me? But anyway, it's not harmless like the puppet movie. Actually, there's millions of rotting corpses, most of them in the ground. At least thousands of them completely obliterated, not even enough left to bury. And, of course, millions of refugees, external and internal, depending on where you draw your national border around there. But just in the 21st century, America has turned the Middle East upside down. Never even mind how it was before that. And, of course, it is true that there was a 20th century before a 21st one. Seriously, I know it doesn't seem like it, but yeah. They don't like to admit on TV that history began before September 11th, but it's true that it did. So, and you know what? Back to Somalia again. I'm not trying to demonize anybody in the Minneapolis area, or anything like that. I'm not trying to be a scaremonger or whatever. I'm just saying I think it's perfectly reasonable to expect that there's going to be a problem with a young, angry Somali nationalist living in America at some point. America has been beating the living crap out of the people of Somalia for now 7 years running. And there have been, it was Peter King, the congressman, so he might have been lying, but he seemed to be referring to some kind of fact that he had heard or something. I don't know. He said, I believe 20 or 24 or something. Anyway, I was already under the impression it was approaching 24 young Somali Americans who have left America to go to Somalia to fight in the jihad there. And in fact, I don't think every single one of them was necessarily even a Somali American. But anyway, it doesn't take much imagination. You don't have to be a scaremongering lunatic like Representative Peter King, who of course is a terrorist, you know, financier himself. But anyway, and I don't mean that indirectly through the state. I mean directly he supported the IRA. He's a, you know, when they set off a bomb, it was on his dime, that kind of thing. But anyway, you don't have to be a scaremonger trying to monger, create a war or a police state somewhere or something to point out that, hey, there are consequences to these kinds of things. The lesson is not clamp down on the people of Minnesota. The lesson is, leave Somalia alone, man. Enough already. If it wasn't for the Americans, the Ugandans, the Burundians, the Kenyans, the Ethiopians, they would withdraw their armies. And the people of Somalia would be left with their crappy country to sort things out the best that they can themselves. Which already is being dealt a pretty lousy hand. Especially picking up from the aftermath of what America has wrought there. But if they're ever to have a chance, the outside powers need to be left alone. And even if they want to be there for whatever internal reasons, none of those countries would be there if it wasn't for the money coming out of your paycheck, paying them to club little babies to death there. And so, I don't know. U.S. out of Somalia. Does anybody care to hear that? By the way, I didn't make up that thing about tungsten rods from God. They've got that. Now, I'm not necessarily the expert on all the properties of tungsten, but apparently it's a pretty damned heavy metal. And I think it's possibly even radioactive or toxic. The metal's very toxic or something. I don't remember exactly. I don't know. Anyway, they want to be able to shoot a tungsten rod at you from space. Or carbon, too. They had, I don't know exactly, you know, which one would work better or not. It's got to be able to, you know, put up with the heat from the friction of reentry in the atmosphere, obviously, without disintegrating. anyway, they want to be able to have satellites fly around in space armed with a bunch of rods. Tungsten or carbon rods. And then if they hate you and want to kill you, they'll push a button and kill you with a rod from God. That's what they call it. It's the Death Star, except individualized. Well, you know, you and whoever happens to be anywhere near you at the time when they decide to murder you. And, of course, Obama, this is from the same geniuses who want to, and I guess they are proceeding with this. Nobody ever stopped them, right? The plan is to start putting, I don't want to say start. Maybe they've already done it. I don't even know. I should know. Let me try to find out. At least they were planning on putting conventional weapons on 3-stage intercontinental ballistic missiles. Conventional bombs. Like the normal kind of satellite-guided munition they would drop from a bomber or whatever. JDAM is the delivery vehicle, right? Forgot. They got the JDAMs and the JSOWs and the J this, that, and the other kind of bombs. Anyway, they want to go ahead and start putting those on ICBMs, which is, of course, the number one quickest way to start a nuclear war. To start a nuclear war that you don't need to have at all. And by the way, on CNN International right now, they're talking about Tatooine, and they're showing the ruins of Mos Eisley somewhere walking around in Tunisia, and I'm on the radio, and so I can't watch it. It's probably stupid. Looks really cool, though. I think they're talking about the encroaching sand dunes are going to come. That's Mos Espa. Not Mos Eisley, I guess. That's cool, though, man, that they really built those buildings up pretty well and then left them behind there. Here come the dunes. All right, well, anyway. There's a guy out, a guy with a new book out. About nuclear bombs and saying what a miracle it is that they haven't gone off accidentally, that a war hasn't broken out accidentally, or that there haven't been major detonation accidents here, there, or in other countries where they've got nukes too. And apparently the book is just a massive catalog of close calls. And sorry to be so redundant for the regular listeners, but still, isn't this the most important thing in the whole world? Don't we have to get rid of the nukes? Don't the people of Earth got to get smart enough to want to deny their politicians the possession of nuclear weapons? You know, you can't just shoot somebody with a nuke. They're for killing lots and lots and lots of people all at the same time with. Too many people. Why should we tolerate this? Why should the Earthlings tolerate any of themselves having freaking H-bombs? Yeah, you gotta keep the Soviets out. Well, the Soviets are gone. Yeah, well, you gotta keep the Americans from attacking you. Well, you're not the Soviets anymore, and so America's not gonna attack you with nukes anymore. So get rid of the H-bombs, for Christ's sake. And the A-bombs, too. I like picking on the H-bombs because they're the ones that could kill your entire city. No matter how big your city is. With one shot. But anyway, this ought to be the 7-billion-man consensus. None of these politicians are allowed to go to work stealing or killing anybody or doing anything ever again until we get them to dismantle their nukes. That's it. That's their one and only job. Dismantling the nukes. And if anybody tries to make nukes again, then we bomb the hell out of them with conventional weapons. No nukes for you or you or you or anyone ever. How about that? Is that really that hard for the people of Earth to imagine? You know what it is? You just haven't seen a picture of a nuke bomb going off in color lately. Or you haven't seen the remnants of a nuclear-bombed city in color, right? You've seen pictures of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but only in black and white, and that was a long time ago. But you know what? Use your imagination a little bit. The average nuclear bomb nowadays is 1,000 times more powerful than that. right? You could kill Houston with a 20 megaton bomb. You could kill all of Houston. If you haven't been to Houston, that's a really big spread out city in the flat Gulf coastal plain of Texas. It's hugemongous. It's in the top five. I don't know the exact ranking anymore. It's among the top five largest cities on the planet. It's the measure of what's a big city to a Texas boy like me. But anyway, so yeah, you know what we should do? We should just put conventional bombs on three-stage intercontinental ballistic missiles, and then that way when President Obama decides he wants to kill somebody within 20 minutes, he can accidentally get entire cities full of humans wiped off the face of the earth. You know, him or Jeb or whoever's next. I guess that's what's fun about being a government employee. There is no responsibility anywhere. It's so diffused, it's non-existent. Hey, I came up with this great plan for putting conventional explosives on three-stage intercontinental ballistic missiles, and that helped me get a promotion and a retirement, and I'm going to retire now. Bye. And if any cities get blown up because of what I did, oh well. Won't be my fault. It'll just be, hey, that's the system or something. Yeah, pardon me for having a problem with that, but, you know, I haven't even read this new book that's out. But I already have, you know, found before on the internet about 20 different times where there was almost a nuclear war due to a misunderstanding. Or some kind of accident. And that's what was already out there on the internet before this new book came out. That's full of crises. And, you know, somebody reminded me the other day. Oh, it was Mike Swanson from Wall Street Window, an author of The War State, reminded me. And I don't know how I had forgotten this, but have you guys ever heard of this one before? You know how the president has his launch codes, and then the two guys in the silo have to turn their key and have to enter in the launch codes separately and this, that, and the other thing? How years ago, they just rolled all the launch codes to zero. They don't do the launch code thing anymore. Really, they just need to turn the two keys. How many Hollywood movies have you seen where the football and the codes are the most important thing in the whole world? The president and his football are the most important thing. But, nah, the guys in North Dakota, they can just shoot off the nukes if they want. Have you ever read Catch-22? If you've ever read Catch-22, you'll get the idea real quick that this is how the military really works. All that crap they sell you is just so much crap. And you know, you'll hear tell, if you know people who are military, when they're being honest and not all flag and flag wavy and slogan chanty, they'll tell you the military's a mess. Yeah, well, that goes to include the guys in the missile silos. Oh, well, don't worry about it. Right, like that story a few weeks back where a guy in charge of a missile silo has been decommissioned and fired. Okay. And why is that? Well, he was doing a really lousy job, apparently. So on one hand, well, good, they got rid of him. But on the other hand, wow, he was doing a really lousy job, so bad you had to get rid of him, huh? And somehow he got that position in the first place. But geez, my imagination was saying only the most serious-minded professionals would ever have a job in a missile silo. Because I want to believe that, please. All right. Sorry, I'll get off of nuclear weapons for a minute, but it just seems, doesn't it seem strange to you how this is not really an issue, nuclear weapons? Yeah, you know, well, the Americans have thousands of them, and the Russians have thousands of them. And the British and the French have hundreds of them. And the Israelis have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. The Pakistanis and the Indians have at least dozens. The Chinese, dozens. Well, they can kill your whole city. And, you know, I saw some mathematician one time, and I don't think he was just being a pompous ass or anything. I think he was really being serious, and he was going, look at this from my mathematical engineering brilliant point of view here, okay? As long as you live in a world with thousands of nuclear weapons, then the probability that one of them is going to go off and kill people is greater than zero. Do you dig it? It's going to happen at some point because of whatever reasons. I read this novel one time years ago about a flock of birds, some kind of condor, flying over the pole. And that's what sets off the nuclear war between the Russians and the Americans. After the end of the Cold War, right? No more Soviet Union. No more Cold War. At least let's pretend to be friends. But now I still annihilate at least the Northern Hemisphere. Anyway. And can you imagine Barack Obama being in charge of hydrogen bombs? Barack Obama. Or if you slant the other way, George W. Bush. Can you imagine George W. Bush in charge of nuclear bombs? I mean, somewhere he's got a little voice on his shoulder telling him, look, you can't nuke anybody, dude, okay? But you gonna count on that? You gonna count on Netanyahu to not use his? That ain't the way I see it. I'm for gun control. Disarm all the governments first and of their worst weapons first. Disarm NATO. Disarm all the national governments. Disarm all the local and state police forces and whatever enforcers and spies. And then only then the individual free human beings of the world, I think, ought to agree to go ahead and put their guns down and do all just fist fights from now on. Tasers or lightsabers or something, you know? But first we got to disarm the governments, and first we got to take away their H-bombs. You know, yesterday. What the hell are we waiting for to take away their H-bombs? It makes no sense to me. All right. And you know what? I know that I'm so cranky, and even though I'm 37 or 38 or whatever the hell, I lost track, that I still sound like just a snot-nosed teenager complaining or whatever. I actually do the cause a disservice, right? Yeah, only some cranky ideological libertarian like Scott Horton would want to get rid of the H-bombs. But thankfully, you know, the reasonable people of Earth don't have to listen to dumbasses like him. Well, it's nice to know that's what I mean to you. Thanks. All right, good. All right, let me spend the last few minutes talking about this thing. I haven't even had a chance to really go through it yet, but I'm gonna. And I'm gonna interview this here lady, too. I sent an email to their people, but they didn't get back to me. But check this out. It's called What the Government Does with Americans' Data. And here's the thing about me that you may already know. And that is that I'm some kinds of smart, sorta, but there are lots of kinds of smart that I am not. One of them, grammar. Another, mathematics. Now, I actually can, with a little bit of help from my friends, install a hard drive into my PC. And I can, with a little bit of help from my friends, crack Adobe Audition and install it on my... No, I can't do that. That's the limit of what I can do. I can install the VLC player. Okay? I cannot crack and install properly a Pirate Bay program like Adobe Audition. I gotta get a friend to help me with that. That's my level of computer skills, okay? So what does that make me, a 2 or something? So, I gotta admit to you, as much as I hate the National Security Agency, as much as I always have since I was a kid and ever heard of such a thing, as much as I've paid attention since the days of Carnivore and Echelon as best I could, I've read all of James Bamford's books, and I've interviewed him over and over again. I've tried to keep track. I have a book by, what's his name? Matthew Aid. I haven't had a chance to read his book yet. It's a bit out of date now, but that's all right. I need to get to that one. But anyway, and I've been trying to keep up with this Greenwald stuff as much as I can. But the truth is, some of us are Marcy Wheeler and the rest of us just ain't, man. And sometimes it's really hard to be this good. By the way, speaking of Marcy Wheeler, real quick, there's a great profile of her in Newsweek. Man, if you're like me and you're a big fan of Marcy Wheeler and her work, emptywheel.net, and you like it when I interview her on the show because how smart she is and stuff, she got great recognition in Newsweek for her great writing. And they talk about how she actually had a job reading legalese for corporations, you know, who got to jump through 10 million regulatory hoops just to exist every day. She was the person who somehow was just gifted with this talent that she can read the most incomprehensible legalese and tell you what it really means. And so that's, you know, her awesome skill. And apparently she's really good at the technical stuff. But man, anyway, I really do just go on and on, don't I? The point is, I can't really understand this NSA stuff well enough to explain it to you good enough. Hey, that was right grammar, wasn't it? Oh, wait, correct grammar? Was my grammar correct there? Anyway. But this is helping. BrennanCenter.org. What the government does with Americans' data. So, of all the Snowden revelations and the admissions by the government since the Snowden revelations started coming out, we've got, what, 24 major news stories, I think. Something like that. Starting with Verizon is collecting all of who calls who for the government. That was the first one. And then there's Prism and giving everything over to the Israelis and the upstream and the downstream and the this, that, and the other freaking thing. And it's a lot. And it's hard to make sense of. So, now AlJazeera.net has a great little timeline of the Snowden revelations and what came out when and what it says, and that's definitely worth your time. But I think this is now in first place for most valuable resource, other than the actual just documents themselves, all at The Guardian, at the NSA files at theguardian.com. What the Government Does with Americans' Data by Rachel Levinson Waldman. And I'm going to read this whole thing over the weekend at some point, I hope, and interview her next week. But what's cool about it is this is made for you and me. This is so that regular people who are not Marcy Wheeler can understand what in the hell all of this is. Because it is complicated. And you know what? If you're one of those geniuses in the audience right now and you're making fun of me, well, when? Maybe it's easy for you, but it's not easy for me to keep track of it all. So, this is all full of charts and timelines and glossaries and explanations. And first they collect the evidence here, and then they transfer it over there. And if it's this technicality, they save it forever. And if it's that technicality, then they don't. I'm paging through it now, and yeah, looks good to me. So this is not that all the Snowden revelations are done being published or anything, but this is all of what we know so far. I guess. What the Government Does with Americans' Data at the Brennan Center for Justice. Sunday on the KPFK show. I don't know. See you then.